life is a life and death proposition. Have you noticed this? And that's kind of what I want to talk about today. Something lighthearted and ebullient for early in the year. That life is a life and death proposition. There are bad things out there, a whole system of things trying to get you. So this will be our warm-up question this morning. I'll give you 8 seconds to think about it and be brilliant. The question is, how does the world get you? How does it get you? How does it get its grip on you? How does it get you? Now, you are all fantastic Christians. Some of you are fantastic Christians. So I'm assuming that the world doesn't get you very often, you know, because you're just like, oh yeah, you're just beyond it. But on the rare occasion when the world gets you, when it defeats you, when it gets your spirit, how does it get you? How does the world get to you? Think about it for 8 seconds and give me your answers. All right, Lee? Fear, yeah. The world gets at you through fear. We have a saying at Blue Water, fear is the start of every bad thing, right? It's an ingredient in most trouble. Yeah, Baron. The smell of baking chocolate chip cookies. So it's just that sort of raw fleshly seduction that that leads you into decay. Right, yeah, I get it. Yeah. There was a hand over here. Who was it? Yeah, bud. Oh, the world gets at you because you allow the world to get you to. That's kind of a brilliant answer, right? You can unpack that one a little bit. The supposition there is that Rod is strong enough to not let the world get him. But when he lets his guard down, right, that's when the trouble begins. That's true. Yeah, Elton. Comfort. Ah, that's interesting. The world gets at you through comfort. You're having a rough day, you're having a rough week, and the world comes along and offers you comfort, but it's not healthy comfort, right? It's a chocolate chip cookie that you know you shouldn't eat because you have a New Year's resolution, but you do it anyway through chocolate chip cookies or stuff that might even be worse than chocolate chip cookies. Yeah. Lust. And not necessarily just for cookies. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Laverne. Ah, yes. The world gets at you by bringing the wrong kind of people, the wrong kind. Let's just look around the room right now and be like, the wrong kind of people. Yeah, yeah. The nice thing about life is it's filled with people, and the rough thing about life is it's filled with people. Was it Lauren? Oh, that's good. Temptation to compare. The world gets at you by provoking you to compare your life with someone else's life, your situation with someone else's situation. It's interesting how many of your responses mirror the Ten Commandments, isn't it? You know, thou shalt not covet, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt know the gods before me. All right, one more. Who's got the best answer? How does the world get at you? John. Oh, that's interesting. So how does the world get at you? Subtly, insidiously, right? It just speaks steadily and softly, right? Not blatantly. Not in some way that you would, of course, see coming. But the world gets at you a little bit at the time. It nibbles at your soul until the whole thing falls apart. Yeah, great answers. Maybe you guys aren't really good Christians. No, of course you are. You just know that it's a fight. One of the great master verses of all of Jesus' teachings comes at us in John 16. I've been thinking about this verse this week. I bet a lot of you already know it. John 16:33, and it comes at the end of a very long conversation that Jesus is having with his disciples, and he's telling them about all the different challenges that they're going to have in this life. And then he says to them, I have told you these things so that in me you may have peace. In this world you will have trouble, but take heart, I have overcome the world. Did you know that one? That's got one of those master verses. It's on a lot of coffee mugs. That's how you know it's good. In this world, some translations will say, in this world you will have trials and tribulations, the older translations. But fear not, but be encouraged, but don't be afraid. I've overcome the world. I've conquered the world. Do you know that command, don't be afraid, is the most oft-repeated command in the entire Bible? It's the most often repeated command in the New Testament. Fear is indeed the start of every bad thing. Whatever happens, don't be afraid. I have overcome the world. I've conquered the world. You don't make friends with the world. You conquer the world. You transcend it. You overcome it. You don't make friends with the world. You have to beat it. You have to beat it. And that's sort of Jesus teaching 101. And I want to talk about that in this new sermon series. I'm going to go to sermon series on the book of Revelation. I was wondering how you might react. Because it's a real spooky, symbolic, prophetic, crazy book at the very end of the Bible. But I love it. I've loved it ever since I was a kid. Because I thought about serious things when I was a kid. I can remember the moment I learned that people die. Tells you a lot about my psyche. So I was 3 years old, and I was playing in the driveway. We were living in Missouri at the time. My family was under some stress because we were running from the police. And we were living in this little shack in this poor end of town, and I was playing in the driveway, and somebody had started a car nearby. And this was like, you know, back in the days of no catalytic converters and leaded gasoline and stuff like that. So there's just fumes billowing out of the back of the car. And to me, it looked like clouds. It was fun. So I was kind of like dancing in the clouds, you know. It's like, yeah. Some people remember. And then the neighbor kid, who was a few years older than me, came over and said, Jody, I was Jody back then. Jody, like, you can't do that. You'll die. And I was like, what are you talking about? Now, I knew that, like, you know, like, bugs could die and stuff like that. But somehow I had not put it together, right? Because humans were this whole other thing, I thought. It's like, what do you mean? And I said, we don't die. I said, no, everybody dies. Like, my grandfather just died recently. People die. And I remember it. I remember it like it was yesterday. And my whole world shifted. Like, I felt it physically in that moment as I stood there in the heavenly clouds. And the stink of the world's toxicity is what it was, right? Right there in the midst of all of that pollution and poison, I was like, death sucks, you know? And it changed my perspective. I remember I ran inside and found my grandmother, and I said, people die? And she said, yeah, people die. And I was like, when? And she said, well, you're not going to die for a long time, honey. And I was like, what about you? This was the same. This is Nana, who died at age 97 3 years ago. She was the grandmother for the church. So, you know, she lived quite some time as well. And it just knocked me on my little okole when I found out about it. The wrongness of it hit me like a flood. And I've never gotten over it. No, I think other people do, right? Because you have to accept it, right? And you just sort of say, it's the circle of life. Let's make a Disney song. And I was like, it is just wrong. And I think there is something fundamental to our spirit that when we see death, we recognize it as wrong. It's just that, you know, healthy people get used to it, and I never did. I don't like it in animals either, which is why I can't even eat meat today. Like, it really, really affected me in a fundamental spiritual way. And I remember thinking, even when I was a tiny kid, why aren't people freaked out about this? You know, I felt like saying to every adult that I met, hey, people are dying here. We need to fix this. We need to fix this. And that was the attitude with which I approached Jesus and faith when I was small. Here's another story. It's odd. It's weird, but it's related. Fast forward, I'm in my 20s now, and I'm living in Chicago. I'm in grad school, and I'm having a terrible time. Maybe you remember some stories from that period in my life that I've shared previously, but I was really depressed at the time, like near suicidally depressed. And part of that was I was insomniac. I couldn't sleep at night. And so Sonia and I had this loft apartment on the south side of Chicago, and she was in bed asleep one night when I couldn't sleep. And I remember I was up pacing in our living room. It was just a big loft, so there was a lot of room to pace. And I was just going back and forth, and I was just praying to God. There's a lot of difficulties in my life at the time. It's like, you got to help me. You got to help me. Like, you got to show up. I want to see your presence. Like, you better do something. And then I remember in my pacing, I turned and happened to look into our kitchen. And this is the weird part. Bear with me. I saw with my physical eyes a demon. I know, right? So it's not the craziest thing I've ever said in church. Am I right? But it's like, this is one time. It's like, you know, I believe they exist, but I like saw physically this shadowy, gloomy figure just for a moment. And it was like he was walking across the kitchen and looked at me. And then I sort of snapped back and I couldn't see him anymore. I immediately felt better and went to bed and fell straight asleep, slept like a baby. Why? It's like, yeah, I knew it. I knew it was weird. But the reason I think it worked like that for me is because I was comforted by seeing behind the curtain, right? That I saw that there was, in fact, a spiritual world, which in a way convinced me that the world in which I lived wasn't the whole story. And somehow that gave me the strength. I felt better. And I was like, oh, yeah, now I'm sane again. Now I'm sane again, right? Maybe you would think, oh, you might have been insane. No, but that actually made me feel sane. It's like, it is a deeply spiritual, eternal, I don't know, transcendent, multidimensional battle. And when I live there, I can overcome the world. When I don't live there, the world often comes close to killing me. Believe it or not, that's a setup to a sermon series on the book of Revelation. Shall I read what I think is probably, Revelation is a long book, it was like for 22 chapters or something. But I'll read you what I think is the most typical verse, the most representative verse in all of the book of Revelation. And it comes early, it's in chapter 2 of the book of Revelation. And this is Jesus talking. He makes an appearance in the book of Revelation, by the way, not just in the Gospels. But he's talking to his disciple John, and he says, "He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To him who overcomes, I will give the right to eat from the tree of life, which is in the paradise of God." Even in that verse, there's some symbolic language, the paradise of God. Well, we don't know exactly everything that's involved in that. The tree of life. Well, that harkens back to the Genesis story. Paradise itself harkens back to the Genesis story. So what Jesus is saying here is, if you overcome the world, then you get to go back to the way it was at the beginning. In other words, you get to go to the way it was supposed to be all along. And that's kind of how I felt when I discovered death for the first time. It's like, it's not supposed to be like this. I know it. I know it's not. Why isn't everyone else freaking out? But a lot of people do. And that to me is what Revelation is about. But the promise here is to him who overcomes, to those who overcome, to them who overcome, I will give the right to beat death ultimately. You know, we'll restore everything back to paradise conditions as it was in our earliest stories about the garden. I think we should live like that every day. I think every day we should sort of have this awareness that, well, this isn't right. You know, this life is terminal. There's a lot of trouble. people are dying all over the world. Either we're going to like freak out like nuts, or we're going to believe in eternity and figure out how to get there and overcome this broken world. But I think most humans live somewhere in between. It's like they don't overcome the world, right? They don't sort of live according to heaven, but they don't think about death either. They're just things that they don't think of, right? They kind of naturalize it. They write Disney songs about it to make it seem beautiful, but it's not beautiful. It is a toxic, gaseous cloud of poison, and we should not be dancing in it. But if we do, we should be overcoming. All right, you get it? Somebody say amen or chihu or something like that. So we begin this new year with a sermon series on the book of Revelation, the last book in the Bible, so it's really easy to find. The book of Revelation was a revelation, a prophecy experience, an out-of-body experience given to this disciple named John. By tradition, the very same John that followed Jesus around and in the gospel stories, the youngest of all the disciples. When he followed Jesus, he was just a teenager. But at this point, he's very old. In fact, at this point, he's probably the only surviving of all the original disciples because everybody but him has been murdered. Most of them have been executed for their faith. John, at this point, they had tried to execute him. There's a miracle story where he was thrown into a vat of boiling oil, but he wouldn't burn. So they took him out and sent him into exile, ultimately, instead. So he's in prison. He's in exile on an island called Patmos. They put him on an island because there's no chance of him getting off and making more Christians. This was during a period of tremendous persecution of Christians during the Roman Empire. Nero is the emperor, and Nero was psycho. And he's the guy that used to like tie Christians to poles in Rome and set them on fire for the entertainment of the crowds. An incredibly wicked man, but by no means the only wicked Roman emperor. For centuries, Rome tried to exterminate Christians like they were cockroaches. And they kept multiplying like cockroaches. Were cockroaches? That might have not been my best analogy. But cockroaches are amazing. They're going to survive the zombie apocalypse. And so John has this revelation directly from the Lord. Jesus appears in this out-of-body experience. Or John is taken to heaven and gets to hang out with Jesus a little bit in his spirit. And then he writes about it to Christians who are being persecuted in the Roman world. But because they're being persecuted, because Christianity is essentially illegal at this point, he writes a lot of it in code. He writes it in coded symbolism. So part of it is just like prophecy, which itself can be very symbolic. And then part of it is code, which can be very symbolic. So it's a little hard to read Revelation accurately, but I think with a little common sense, we can get through it. But it's a weird book. It gives us all of the symbols that Hollywood likes to use. You know, the beast, the famous beast, 666, the number of the beast. That's in the book of Revelation. Armageddon, the famous Battle of Armageddon, that's in the book of Revelation. All of these apocalyptic things are in there. It's awesome. And it's often avoided in churches as a result because it's a little bit trippy. But I think it might be the truest book in the entire Bible. And the reason I say I think it might be the truest book is because I think it presents the essential whole truth most completely. Soup to nuts, A to Z, beginning to end. Genesis to the restoration of the tree of life. Alpha and Omega, as Jesus says in the last line of the book. It gets to the heart of it in a way that other books, they're also true, but they're only part of the story. And Revelation tries to paint the whole story for us. It presents what I call the big reality of life. And the big reality of life is that life is life and death, right? And that there is another world, and you have to conquer this one. You have to get over it. Otherwise, you die. You know, you're snuffed out. And that's wrong. That's not how it should be. So that's what I call the big reality. And we all face a test in which we must overcome the entire world system in order to escape to the next life. A world system that, as we have noted, tries to seduce us and deceive us and intimidate us and, more than anything else, control us. One of the things you've heard me say a lot is that the world, Satan, the enemy, the system, tries to control you. God tries to restore your self-control. That's what Paul says. The Spirit of God, the Spirit God gave us is not a spirit of fear. It's a spirit of power, a sound mind, and self-control. Self-control. Only God makes actual individuals. Every ungodly person is controlled by the world. That's what the Bible says. All right, so I'm going to give you a very quick roadmap of the entire book here in the next 6 minutes. And then you'll kind of know where we're headed. And then I'll bring the sermon to a fabulous close. You'll all be very moved and the power will come. And that's all I'm going to do today. So I'm just going to sketch it out just so you know what it is that we're getting into. It's one of those books where you want a little roadmap as you entered it. Chapters 1 through 3, there's about 22 chapters. Chapters 1 through 3 are letters that John writes to various churches in Asia Minor. So this would be churches in more or less Turkey, in the country of Turkey today. Seven different churches, and he writes them after he has this tremendous vision so that they would understand what's really going on, so that they would remember what the big reality is. He reminds these churches and the people in these churches that the battle of life centers on character issues. You know, it's like individual behavior. Like, we don't win this world by being part of a big Christian union. We win the battle by just being good Jesus people. You know, and so he's reminding people to pay attention to that stuff, even in the midst of tremendous, murderous persecution and oppression. Even in the midst of it, he says, yeah, they're trying to kill you. They killed your aunties. They killed your uncles. I just want to remind you to live like a Christian, because that's the only way that we're going to make it, people. That's that. If you cruise, you lose. So chapters 1 through 3 are letters to the churches where he says, if you cruise, you lose, guys. Chapters 4 and 5 is a vision of the world behind the curtain, the sort of, you know, view into spiritual reality that comforts me when I'm having very depressive periods in my life. It centers on a picture of Jesus represented symbolically. He appears in heaven sitting on a throne as a lamb who was slain. There's all these other symbolic things around him. It's just a glorious, beautiful picture. There's a sea of glass in front of the throne in different colors and stuff like this. It's one of the favorite passages of the Bible in my family, because when Jeremiah was, how old was he, 4? He had a dream. He's a big prophetic dreamer, my son Jeremiah. And he woke up one morning and said, I had this dream. It was like in heaven, and there was this throne, and there was like this sea of ice in front of the throne. It looked like an ice. He described Revelation 5 exactly. He said it looked like an ice skating rink. Yeah, sea of glass, ice skating rink. You get the idea, right? But for a 4-year-old, same. But it's like, in other words, it really exists, you know, and you have to decode the symbolism a little bit. The central role of Jesus, of Christ, appears in this epic vision. And he is presented as a warrior who fought his war by dying. By dying selflessly, which is really trippy. But it set history on its ear. And the church has grown ever since. Chapters 6 through 16, kind of like the famous part of Revelations, they are brutal, brutal chapters. And they're brutal chapters because they describe the suffering of the earth. the suffering of the earth. The earth has been broken and suffering for countless thousands of years, but we see this vision in heaven in which God, in the person of Jesus, releases the suffering that he has until then been holding back, right? As bad as life is, it would be way worse if God wasn't gracious to us. But we see a picture of him saying, all right, now we got to let the rest of the rocks roll down the hill. And then life gets really serious, and it describes all of that and everything that goes into it, these plagues and pestilences and wars and stuff like that. But the idea is that all of this suffering is purposeful. Purposeful. Because it causes people to make choices. If life were ideal, we wouldn't have to make any choices. But because life is hard and going to get harder, you know, you have to decide whether your faith actually counts. That's what it's about. So people decide their faith counts, and a lot of people decide that it does not. Right in the middle of it, in chapters 13 and 14, is when we get all these trippy pictures of the beast rising out of the sea, and it's got, you know, all these heads and all these horns, and it's like, and it's crazy unless you know how to decode the prophetic symbolism, in which case it's really easy. But the enemy of people, the enemy of faithful people, is presented not as like the devil. The enemy is presented as a beast, which is to say a whole system, a whole world system. It's not just like one demon. It's like, no, it's the system of the world that tries to control you in a thousand different ways. And then the book describes all the ways that the system tries to control you. Money, you know, trade. That's actually what 666 is about. If you don't have the government stamp, then you can't play in the market, right? Roman policy, a little bit later, was under the Emperor Diocletian, was precisely that. In order to trade, in order to sell your goods and to buy things in the entire Roman Emperor, you would have to get the certificate. I think it was called a libellus, something like that. I don't know Latin very well. And what you have to do is you'd have to go into a temple, take a pitch of incense and put it on the altar and say, Caesar is God. And then they give you a certificate that allows you to go to work or go to school or whatever. Draw your own COVID analogies. And that policy was targeted at Christians precisely because Christians would not say Caesar is God. So it was precisely to exterminate Christians. The most powerful empire the world had ever known dedicated all of its might to exterminating Christians. Whew, we made it. And multiplied. But anyway, that's what 666 is about. All these ways that the world tries to control you, all the falseness, all the deceptions, all the economic pressures and stuff like that. That's what that is about. You're fighting an entire system, people. And it has ever been thus. The world marks you, categorizes you, organizes you, pretends to help you, scares you, protects you, sort of. Takes away your freedom, offers a little bit back, in order to control you. It's all a huge game, and Revelation is just on and on about that. That's really what the book is about. And so there's an encouragement for us to be otherworldly, to live behind the curtain instead of in front of it. And then in chapters 17 through 20, you get like the great battle of good and evil. This is where Christ comes to earth. He's got, you know, the power of truth in his mouth, and they fight ultimately the big battle of Armageddon, which is against the beasts and the false prophets and everybody who follows them versus Jesus and his followers. And it also is very symbolic, although Armageddon is a real place in Israel. But it's like the final showdown. And at the end of that, I'm happy to say the culmination of all world history, the end of the book of Revelation, death itself is destroyed. Death itself is destroyed. Death is thrown into the lake of fire, and it goes away. No more death. See, I knew it was wrong. I knew it. I had not quite read the book of Revelation at age 3, but I knew that death was supposed to be destroyed because God hates death. And then in chapters 20 through 22, you see the restoration. There's a new heaven and a new earth. It's sort of like earth is just rejuvenated. It goes back to the way that it was, and what we have always suspected should be becomes real. That's what the book is about. There is an epic payoff. And the main point of it all, and I guess the point of this meandering sermon today, is that there's, you know, a core message in the book throughout, appears in almost every chapter, every other chapter, which is essentially this. You can opt in or you can opt out. Opting in is going to be hard. It's going to be hard because there is an entire world system designed to destroy you. And so when you opt in, you're making a choice to conquer the entire world, all of its systems, all of its control, all of its everything, you know. Of course, if you opt out, you die. Your choice. And those of you who are Bible geeks will know that this is the choice that God gave the Israelites way back in the book of Exodus. I set before you today life or death. Please choose life. Well, what does that mean? Well, it's going to be hard. You're going to have to cross the wilderness. You're going to have to be a different people. You're going to have to be a whole kingdom of priests. You're going to have to go priest mode, baby. Like all of this stuff we did in Exodus series recently. But the choice is still the choice. You're kind of between a rock and a hard place. You're between persecution and hardship and death. But, I don't know, you can opt in or you can opt out. But make no mistake, opting in takes muscle. If you cruise, you lose. That's where the book begins. And so I begin the sermon series just by throwing that invitation out there. Do you want in? Or are you freaked out? You are agreeable to the point of trouble, Kat. Yeah. Revelation tells us that there's a restorative role in our lives for something that sometimes the Bible calls consecration. Are you willing to make yourself consecrated? Literally, that means make yourself sacred. Are you willing to make your life sacred? To sort of set it aside for heaven, as opposed to letting it be designed and conducted by the world. Are you ready to consecrate your life? And that's really what Revelation is saying. It's like, you know, it's not enough just to kind of say, oh yeah, there's a God. You have to consecrate. You have to be different in everything. Are you willing to make your time sacred? Or are you just one of those people who let your schedule happen to you, right? And that actually matters in a battle where the entire world is trying to mess you up, right? You have to be willing to consecrate time. Are you willing to consecrate your mind? Or are you willing to let just any old thing come into it and any old thing come out of it, right? There's a lot of discipline here. Are you ready to consecrate your money? The world is trying to get at you definitely through its money systems. So Jesus talks about money more than any other moral issue. Because that's how the world gets at us, you know, all the time. So are you willing to consecrate your money to, you know, dedicate it to God first and foremost and stuff like that? Are you ready to consecrate your flesh? You know, we mentioned lust, whether chocolate chip cookies or something else. Are you willing to actually take all of your appetites and make them sacred and special and different? That's hard, man. That is really hard in a world that is throwing stuff to entice all of our base appetites, right? So it's a significant battle, and a lot of us don't do very well in that regard. Are we willing to consecrate our relationships? Laverne was talking about how people often are how the world gets at us. Are we willing to conduct our relationships in a consecrated, holy, special way? Are we willing to make them purposeful? Or are we just gonna, you know, take people as they come and make every relationship as easy as possible, avoid awkwardness at all costs, you know, take our comfort where we find it? being a consecrated person makes you, you have to think all the time, man. I mean, you have to be at it every day, every day. And that's the message. If you cruise, you lose. You know, he's writing letters to all of these churches. It's like, hey, it's hard and it's about to get harder. And sometimes when it's easy, we do worse, don't we? Because we relax and the world gets at us that way. I really want everybody at Blue Water to be consecrated, to be untethered from the world. Because I want us all to make it. Because, I mean, you shouldn't die. I mean, that is so wrong, people. That is so wrong. We should be upset about this. We should be upset about this. And we should be on it every day. And then finally, the reason I want to talk about Revelation is because I think 2025 is supposed to be for us a year of some rather astonishing miracles. You know, and you know who does miracles? People who live in the next world, right? People who live in that miraculous place rather than living in this ordinary place. Do you know what I mean? Do you know what I mean? And that just doesn't happen because you snap your fingers. It happens because you have chosen a consecrated lifestyle. You know, because you live like Jesus lived. And he lived in a strange way. But man, did he do some cool stuff. And he changed the world. And I really think that God has in mind for us to do some serious world change this year. But it's going to start with us being very weird people. Look to your left and right. Somebody square in the face and say, weird people. The Lord is looking for some decent conduits by which heaven can flow into this deathly place. And you're all eligible if you want to be. You can be conduits of heaven to a broken world. I want to just pray for a second. Let's just invite the Holy Spirit to come and fall upon us. And I think probably a lot of us here have opted in. Like, we've been in this battle for a long time. We've made our lives all about this. And God bless us if we have. But even the veterans need fortification from time to time. Because the thing about the world is that, yeah, it's everywhere. It's everywhere. And it keeps trying to get at you. And then there are some folks here who are just kind of seeking the Lord. It's like, I'm kind of digging this. I'm kind of digging the life that I find in Jesus and God. I'm kind of digging it. I want to be careful not to cruise, though. I want to be careful not to cruise. So this is a chance for you to prioritize, which is a very mundane way of saying, get things straight. First things first. God first and foremost. And maybe you want to make a commitment and a dedication. You want to opt in a full way instead of a casual consumeristic way. And then there are some people that are like, well, man, I don't know. And God bless you, because the world is hard for all of us. And there's never any judgment in the church of God. There is only grace and encouragement. Keep going is my message to you. Keep going. Keep going honestly, and any honest person, if they think honestly, will find God. But to think honestly is a savage pursuit. Keep going. You'll have to work at it. Holy Spirit, come and talk to us today. I pray that you speak to our hearts and minds. Reach out to us through the toxic fumes in which we dance. You set before us life and death. Many of us want to choose life.